It's July 22nd, 2003. This is Gordon Puller interviewing Ivor Milutin at the Digifognak camp. Thank you, Ivor, for agreeing to do this interview.
You're welcome, Gordon.
Could we start out with you just giving a little background on when and where you were born and who your family members are?
Yeah, my name is Ivor Milutin. I was born in Kodiak on June 30th, 1931. And my mother and dad were both born in a fog neck, and most of my family was born in a fog neck. I think three were born in Kodiak, and maybe five were born in a fog neck. But anyway, one of the questions that I was asked earlier was, when did the Milutins come to Kodiak? And I thought that was kind of an interesting question, and not knowing how to answer that, I called Dr. Lydia Black, a renowned genealogist and historian or whatever, and she put a little piece of paper together for me, and she said that in her research, she found that two Milutin brothers came to Kodiak with Baranoff when he came here. She didn't give me the date or the specific time or anything else other than that. Two Milutin brothers came to Kodiak with Baranoff, and probably one of those was my great-grandpa, great-great-grandpa, whatever, Ed Nebedich. We're doing the research now, and we'll find out in time, I'm sure. But other than that, I guess that's on my dad's side. On my mother's side, her grandpa was Jacob Lehtonen, came from Vyborg, Finland, and he was an employee for the Russian American Company. And In his employment, he was always in the supervisory capacity, and he had a lot to do with the native sea otter hunters. He was kind of the manager of some of the larger places that the Russian American Company had settled in. The Komandorsky Islands off Kamchatka, he was the manager of one of those islands, and then later to Atka and different places. But anyway, he had a son, Jacob Lehtonen, and then that was my, excuse me, John Lehtonen, and that was my mother's dad. And Jacob, her grandpa, married and a Lesnica. And then I'm not sure if he came from Sitka to Kodiak or if he came from out west, from Russia to Kodiak, but at any rate, he came from Finland, and that's how the Lehtonens got to Kodiak. And he was supposed to retire at Nanilchik, but he chose to retire to another retirement village at the Russian American Company. He had a fog neck. They had one other one that was little fog neck, but for whatever the reason were, he chose a fog neck, and that's where he later died. And so that's the Lehtonens.
So what was your mother's name?
My mother's name was Pelageya Lehtonen, and my dad's name was Sinafont Milutin. And
You said you were born in Kodiak, but your parents were both born in a fog neck. Did that mean that even though you were being raised in Kodiak, that you made visits to a fog neck during your youth?
Oh. Well, Fog Neck was our second home, and Karlik was our third home. And we were at a Fog Neck all the time because we had so many relatives there. We just had so many relatives, and we had so my mother, when Kodiak had a cannery in Kodiak, this was in the late 30s, before the war. My mother would work in the cannery, and she would ship all the kids out to her relatives, and I always ended up in Fog Neck, and Karlik and Annie always ended up in Zimki, and it was kind of fun. And there was a house down on the beach by the old cannery at Kodiak there, and we stayed there. When I remember, we did stay there, but it seemed like we didn't stay very long because we were gone. Then she would chip us out, and I would stay with my Uncle Jacob Lehtonen at Karlik, and a renowned family from Karlik. There's so many Lehtonens. And but a fog neck is really my really soft spot in my heart.
Who did you stay with in a fog neck?
But my mother's sister, with Auntie Lucy, Lucy Grigoryov, and the good thing about that is she had, I think, 7 or 8 daughters, and she didn't have any boys. And that's why I was a king when I went there, and I got the royal carpet every time I was there, and it was just so nice over there. They had chickens over there. They had a big yard. We had to pack water and chop wood. And then in the spring, if I went there in the spring, we'd have to help her get the gardens ready, dig the gardens, go down the beach, and they'd haul kelp and for the fertilizer for the gardens, and then we would help them plant. And then comes the horrible part of weeding. Once they everything started growing, then we were weeding, and it would be from morning till night. And it was fun. It was fun. And believe it or not, I think, as I look back, I hate to state it because it doesn't really fit in the settings a lot of times, but most of the time we were raised as Russians. And the reason I'm going to say that is my mother told me how, when she was a young girl, the Russians brought the cattle over to a fog neck, and they had herds of cattle over there. And when she grew up, they had the cattle, and they were making all their dairy products out of milk. And then they planted potato gardens, and that was from the Russians' influence. And also, a fog neck is in Kodiak had huge berry patches, raspberries. And even today, there's raspberries patches all over Fognik, Uzinki, and Kodiak, and no other place on the island. And that's the difference between those three villages and the rest of the villages. Not to say that one is better than the other, not at all, except that we just had a different influence by the people that moved in. And I could see it even today that the influence is still there. I talk to people that come from Russia. Father Daniel, he's a Russian priest at Anchorage right now. He's setting up a Slavonic parish. And he told me that the story that I told him, the people in Russia live the same today as we did in the past. And he said that's the best life. And he's true. And just to go a little bit further on Russian influence in Kodiak, right where the Salvation Army building us today used to be my mom's and dad's potato garden. And right where the KEA oldest power plant is, not the new one but the old power plant, used to be our potato garden. And everybody in town had huge potato gardens. And the thing about the Aleut people, they never were greedy people. What they did is, if they chose not to plant their garden again or just gave it up, then somebody else would come and they'd plant there. They didn't stake the corners and own the land. They never believed in that. And if you look at the documentation of the Aleuts, they never did that. And I think that is really a plus. So anyway, I look at that and I look back at the Russian lifestyle. It was a heavily influenced. And my dad only went to Russian school. He never went to any other school. So that's why we are so heavily influenced by Russian. I was in one of the sessions here this morning with the Aleutic language. Really interesting. I can understand most of it, but I can speak very little, but I can speak much more Russian and understand much more Russian than they could Aleut.
So did you speak Russian as a child?
No. I wish I would have. But at that point, when we were growing up, my mother, her first language was Russian. Her second language was Aleut, and her third language was English when the older kids were born. And after the older kids grew up and then we came along, then my mother and dad changed their language. Their primary language was English, second was Russian, and their third was Aleut. So they would speak very little Russian to us and just about no Aleut. And there were times when they would speak, like one sentence would have three different languages in it, and that happened a lot. So, but my mother and dad learned English better than I learned Russian.
So when you stayed in a fog neck, then you were in what they called Russian Town or Derevnya?
Yeah, we were in Derevnya, and that's interesting too, because in Lola Harvey's book, Derevnya's Daughter, she makes reference to Derevnya, and then she makes a reference to Aleut Town. And by the time I was a kid and growing up, it was more intermingled than it was like separated before, but even still the Elgees were staying down in one, the far end or the north end of a fog neck, and the other people were staying in Derevnya on the south side. And but there was definitely a distinction in the village. They called it Derevnya and Elgeetown.
Were there any tensions between the two parts of the village?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, they were all related, and it just depended on where you lived, if what they called you. And no, there was absolutely none, because it was just the same people and same family living in one area and another. Let me see. No, there was absolutely no tension. It was just such a peaceful life over there. There was no such thing as tension in them days. And money meant nothing. When I was growing up as a kid, money meant nothing. When I got in high school, that's when I started needing money. Other than that, I think that my mother and dad lived a much, much better lifestyle than we live today, because they had so much less problems with things like that. No, there was never no stealing. You never locked anything. There was no need to. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted a cup of tea, or if you wanted tea and bread, dinner, lunch, supper, you just go visit anybody and you could go and eat. That's the way the people lived in the Fog Neck and Kodiak and Yuzinki, and probably all the villages, Karlik too. And it's not that way anymore. So we've lost a lot.
I know that you've been very active in the Russian Orthodox Church probably all your life. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think that if I'm going to talk about the church, first of all, I have to talk about my dad, because he was the one that was really involved with the church more than anybody in our family, and even to the point where he was going to be ordained a priest. And whatever the reasons were, my mother stopped him. And he was a choir director, and he was a starosta. He was the caretaker of the church. He was the caretaker of the church, and they moved to Kodiak, I think, in 1914. And for many years, he never got paid, and didn't matter. He just took care of the church, and then later on, he got $10 a month. And when he got a little bit more money, they got paying him $50 a month. And then we were going to church constantly from day one, and we grew up with the church. In fact, Metropolitan Irene told my dad that as long as my dad was alive or my mother was alive, we could live in the church house, and that's what we did. So we lived in the church house, which was two houses away from the church. And my dad was heavily involved with the church, and one of the things that I remember really, really distinctly was in 1943, July 17th, the Russian church burned in Kodiak. And that church was built in 1894. And later on, when they were taking the church apart, I happened to be right where the men were working, and they were rolling over a log, and I found a lead plaque inscribed with the Russian names of the Russian men that built that church in the year, and that was in 1894. And it seems to me like Chernoff and Walkoff were two names that were on there, and I don't remember the other one, but anyway, the little lead plaque is in the St. Herman archives in the museum. So,
What do you recall about the church in a fog neck?
The church in a fog neck. All I can tell you about the church in the fog was really a pretty church. It was all hand-hewed by mostly the Sheratines and whoever else. The reason I say mostly the Sheratines is because that's all I hear people talking about, the Sheratines, what good work that they were doing, and they were so instrumental in building the church. And Andrew, I think, was one of the main carpenters, and Nikolai, and pretty church, and it was all built by hand, all log. I don't know the year it was built, but it was just a super nice log building. And it's all deteriorating now.
Do you recall the priests that were there at that time?
Well, when I was growing up, the only priest that my mother ever made reference to in a fog neck was Father Gerasim. And then later he was in Yuzinki all the time, and then later at Spruce Island in Monk's Lagoon. But other than that, no, I don't know. The Kodiak always had a priest. Mm-hmm. And I can remember all the priests that Kodiak ever had.
I know that you were very active after the Land Claims Act was passed in the early days of the establishment of Koniag. I remember you were on the board. Do you care to share any thing about that?
It's all good memories, and there were such good guys that were on, and it's just amazing to see where we were then and where we're at today based on the knowledge that we had confronting something that was just a big, big question mark, not knowing anything about corporations, knowing anything about government regulations and how they applied, and they had to learn all of that, and it was really something when the formation, first of all, Canna formed Koniag in 1972, and that was the first meeting, and they formed an interim board, and after they had that interim board for 1 year, and then they incorporated the new corporation of Koniag. The interim board did that, and after the incorporation, I was on the interim board, and then I also got onto the first Koniag board. And after we got on, got elected to the permanent board, it was really, really a big question mark in my mind. And in the first place, Koniag was supposed to be the recipient of all the funds that come in from Washington, D.C. that would be distributed to the villages based on the number of people each person would get an equal share, and based on if they were in a village or if they were in the natives of Kodiak or if they were at large, or they would get a different distribution. And it was really, really a puzzle. But things happened where we had the expertise that could work with that and deal with that, because I couldn't do it. And I remember Carl Armstrong, one of our leaders that was really, really probably the most significant instrumental person in Koniag because of his knowledge, and he could foresee and he knew. It seemed to me he had a foresight that we didn't have, and he would give that to us, and then we were able to move along and make decisions based on what he would tell us. But it was really tough, and everything was difficult. Land selection was difficult, and enrollment. To this day, I just cannot understand anybody in their right mind branding any group of people, and having you place your blood quantum on a piece of paper saying that you are this. It's totally impossible, and we did the best that we could, and I think that we come out okay. But still, there is no way in the world that they could ever, the federal government or anybody can, in my estimation, find the blood count of any single person. They just can't do it, and we had to do that. And if we were 25% Aleut and 50% Norwegian or whatever, we're an Aleut. That's all we are as a native. And I think that the way that they should have did it, and I just thought about it later, and it should have been the same as the Indian down south. They should have been just a descendant of, and forget about the blood quantum. Then they would have come out correct, but they didn't do that. And since they didn't do that, they tried to establish laws to say that people that were 25% would qualify and others didn't, but that didn't work. So now, for whatever the reasons are, they're going to descendants of, and I think that's a much more equitable way to treat the native people versus the Indian people, and I think that it'll work out. And I think that way the natives are going to strive for many, many, many years. But if we had to be 25% to be a native, then they would just all be died, all be gone in the next 50 years probably. So,
well, I think that's an excellent point. I don't know how anyone can say with absolute certainty what percentage they are of anything. We really don't know.
You know, we did, Ione and I. You remember Ione Norton? Ione Norton, she's pretty darn smart. Smarter than me. She said, "Abba, what are we going to do?" I said, "What do you mean, what are we going to do? We're going to make everybody in our family eligible." I said, "That's what every family has to do. We're going to go tell everybody to make everybody. How are we going to do that?" I said, "Well, we'll start with the youngest ones. My nieces and nephews are the youngest. They're going to be 25%. And I said, "Who cares what my mother and dad have to be? That's what they're going to end up. Whatever they have to be, once we add the the quantums up, and it just so happened my mother and dad had to be 50% apiece, each, you know, and that wasn't unreasonable. Send a form out to everyone in our family, mailed it out, and no problem. And I wish everybody would have did that. Then we would have no trouble, make everybody eligible.
There was an emotional and controversial time during the history of the corporation when the mergers were proposed with the village corporations. Were you involved with Koniag when that was happening?
Yeah, we did have, it was kind of controversial. Oh, yeah, and we were really involved because the reason we were involved is I was the first president of a fog neck, and our goal was to merge with Port Lions even before enrollment was finalized. And brothers and sisters were in Fog Neck and Port Lions, and they were separated, and aunts and uncles, husband and wife, so it was our goal to merge. And we pushed merging very, very strongly. And I knew John Trively really well, and he was the president of NANA. And we talked to him a lot and communicated with him a lot. And after a lot of, you're right, controversy, for some reason, NANA was able to get that through. And they got it to Congress, and they amended ANSCA, and they passed the bill, and next thing you know, NANA was merged, and then the Fog Neck was merged. The first two village corporations to merge was the Fog Neck and Port Lions.
So you were the first president of Fog Neck.
Yeah.
Can you tell about that experience of getting it started and how you were
Really exciting. In the first place, David Pestrikov was the chief enumerator, and he went to Anchorage to learn and get the procedures on enrolling people. So he came back and he hired 8 people, and Marie Pearson lived right across the street from me, and she came over to my house, and I was the first person she was going to enroll. So she came over with all her papers and start filling them out, and later on she said, "Ivor, you know, there's a $10,000 fine if you lie." I said, "Oh, that's okay. That's good." Anyway, we began to fill out the papers, and I got to this one little box in the form, and it's number 16. And that is the place of your enrollment, the village that you enrolled to. We called it column 16. And I put a fog neck. And Marie said, "Ivor, you can't do that." I said, "What do you mean I can't do that?" She said, "Well, a fog neck's not a village." I said, "A fog neck's listed second in the act. It's the second village in the act." She said, "But a fog neck's washed out with the title. Would they move to Port Lyons?" I said, "Marie, you told me only if I lie I would get fined." She said, "Yeah, I'm going to leave a fog neck in the block." I said, "My whole family's going to enroll to a fog neck." She said, "Okay." So anyway, little did I know that Eunice Nested and Marion Brown, two of the leaders that, you know, they were born and raised in a fog neck, were having meetings with the fog neck. So I got involved, and I found out, and I went down there and joined them, and a lot of fun. And they were having their informal meetings, and Eunice Nissen was kind of the acting president. And I still have some minutes of their meetings, and here's how some of the minutes went. "Well, Marion, it looked like we've been talking for quite a while. It's time to have a cup of chai." So that would be in the minutes, and I thought that was pretty cute. And anyway, I just kept going to the meetings, and Marion said, "Ivor, how would you like to be the president?" I said, "That would be really neat." And Eunice said, "Yeah, we'll elect you the president of a fog neck." I said, "Yeah, but we're not certified, we don't have anything." She said, "That's okay." So they did, they elected me, and I forget who else was elected. And so then I started meeting with Koniag, with Carl. And we needed money. At that time, BIA sent Koniag $500,000 for the implementation of ANSCA at the beginning to the villages to help them get started, give them so much money. So I went there and tried to get the money. He said they wouldn't give us any money. And so we fought them for I think 2 years. They wouldn't give us a penny, and rightfully so, because if they give us the money, we'd spend it, and then if we weren't certified, then it's gone. And we understood that. So anyway, we had meetings for 2 years without money.
And in 1974, we finally had a court hearing, and the federal government sent his attorneys and judges to Kodiak, and we had a hearing at the court building, Kuguyagan and Fognak, and we prevailed. And so then right after that, certification came in 1974, we were certified. And then we were on track to start selecting our land, and Kuguyagan was giving us money, and right after that we elected a Fognak permanent board, and I was the first president. I stayed there for 5 years. And after that, then Dick Wamser came on board, and another instrumental person for Fognak, because one of the interesting things about Dick is Willis Nelson was our land chief, and he was selecting land based on the information that he got from Carl and the information that he got from BLM. But Dick came over and he looked at the map and he said, "I've got to show you something." And we had about a month before deadline for land selection. And he said, "You know, Fognak got a double court township." I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He said, "That means that we have two court townships. You know, based on the old selection method, there was one was a court township, and then you'd go 1, 2, 3, north, south, east, and west, and you put a rectangle around the whole total city, and that you could select all the land in that rectangle. But now, and we would only reach Danger Bay. North from a Fognak with Danger Bay was our boundary. But moving and giving us another core township north moved us another 6 miles into Issued Bay. So that made it, we were able to encompass all that timber in Issued Bay based on the double core township. And boy, BLM didn't like that. But there's nothing they could do. Dick was right. And he said, "You know, Port Lyons has a double-court township. They can do the same thing, but it's in a different way." I said, "Whoa, how do we talk to Herman?" So we talked to Herman, and we talked merger. And then Dick finally made all the selections for Port Lyons and a Fognak, moving a Fognak off of a Fognak village area and let Port Lyons get as much as they could on a Fognak and Kajuyak, whoever, and Dick did all their selections. And one of the problems we were having was with Herman. Fognak had 404 people. Fognak had 118. And 100 was the magic number. You got 69,120 acres if you had 100 people. If you had 400 people, you get, I think it's 161 or 62,000 acres plus. And we needed to get up to that 400 to get that last 23,000 acres. And Herman wouldn't give us anybody out of Port Lyons, and here we're going to merge. So we had a heck of a battle with Herman, and we finally convinced him to give us them and 118 people to get us over 400 so we could get our six townships. And a Fognak ended up being the biggest township of all the villages. We got six townships.
So who is Herman?
Huh?
You're referring to Herman?
Herman Hawkinson.
Okay.
Yeah. He was really a neat person, but once in a while when he would get drunk, you couldn't deal with him, just like anybody else. But when he was sober, he was really a neat person. We could deal with him. And then, like you say, when we merged with Port Lyons, that was the worst business deal anybody could ever make as far as dollar for dollar. A Fognak lost so much money. At that time, Port Lyons had invested in the Smokwa, that floating processor, and they were going downhill, and they only had 118 people, so they never had much money to start with. So they burned up most of their money, so we had to bail them out. Fognak bailed them out, and we took a loss on our stock, but we didn't care. It didn't matter. Money didn't matter to me anything. So that's the way it was.
Well, who else was on that first Fognak board?
I got them all at I think Carl Ellison and Pete Olson and Julie Knagan, Mary Ann Fern, Arlene Nelson, Pasha Jamelli. Oh, gosh, I can't remember all of them. But good people. Dick Wamser, Tommy Frost. They were all the original members.
Do you remember who was involved with the Port Lance Corporation?
Well, Herman Hoskinson was the top gun, and then they had Patty Mullen, Reggie Gunderson. They were the two that we met with all the time, Patty and Reggie. And I just don't know who the other Port Lions board members are. I got them at home. They're all written down, but I just don't have them right now. But I know Patty and Reggie and Herman, we dealt with all the time.
Well, it sounds like you were really thinking ahead more as a people rather than strictly a corporation and trying to get people together?
Oh, yeah. That was our goal. But to get the... In my estimation, to get the best for the people, whatever we could, however we could, and no matter what it really meant, and that's what we did. And then later on, come to be big task of trying to take a look at all of our assets that we had, namely timber, and see how the heck we could make a dollar out of them. And so we went. One of the good things about the Afognak board, and I attribute this to even today, to the success of Afognak, is there's only four words that I could think of the success of Afognak. And the four words are no drinking and common sense. That's the only four little words I could think of that is the reason that Afognak is doing so well. And the credibility of that board, I'd put it up against any board because of that. And when I was on the board, and all the time I went to meetings, there was never no alcohol. It never was a factor. And based on that, they were always in their right mind, and they could make a good decision based on their consultants or whatever else they had to do, and they could listen, and that's what they did, and that's what they're still doing today. And I think that's the reason the success of Afognak.